At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Every team, every topic, everywhere, this is Believe.
What is happening, gang? We have got an exciting episode this week on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. In today's episode, we get to talk about something that, hey, I'm not panicking, but it'd be good to know, how do roster transactions happen during the season? What is Bill's philosophy? So he breaks down the various ways that your teams can acquire players, let go of players, how active of a trade season he thinks it's going to be, and then ultimately a little bit of a deep dive into the Panthers-Jaguars trade from this week that I think might have some consequence in the NFC South. But before we dive into today's episode, I want to take a minute and talk about one of our favorite sponsors on the pod, Bet Online. We're back and better than ever. All eyes are on the gridiron as teams are back on for another football season. As always, Bet Online is your number one spot for all your pro and college football action this season. With a new updated site and interface, even more odds, props, and contests. We went through it last week, but we got that old. Who's going to be the coach at USC? I'm hoping it's not going to be James Franklin. Bet Online continues to be the number one source for everything football. So where are you waiting for? Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% off welcome bonus on your first deposit. Don't forget to use the promo code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, to receive your bonus. From football, basketball, boxing, right to your favorite Vegas casino games, don't wait to take advantage of the amazing offers available for 2021. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your favorite sports. BetOnline, where the game starts. All right, gang, this is a fun one. We're also going to dive into some thoughts Bill had on week three in the NFL, and it's going to dovetail into some pretty interesting stuff about offensive line coaches. This is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and this is our look at roster construction during the season. All right, what is happening, gang? We are live on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, coming off the heels of one of my favorite episodes we've ever done with Mike Pereira. Still got my fandom nerd out from that one. How are we doing today, guys?
Good, thank you. Interestingly enough, before we get going on the other subjects, let's put a bow around the Mike production. We had a big game-changing miss by the officials this week in the Detroit-Baltimore game, where they fouled up the clock. The clock didn't foul up. They fouled up the administration of what should have been a penalty. Baltimore should have been called for delay of game, and that would have pushed the field goal try back to 71 yards, which I doubt they would have gone for. And it would have, with 2 or 3 seconds on the clock, it would have resulted in a Hail Mary, which may or may not have been successful. But the kick, which may well put Tucker into the Hall of Fame, should never have been made, at least from that distance. And there is an easy fix to it. The easy fix is to take it out of the hands of the back judge, who may have been out of position, may have been screened out, may have just been slow. I heard yesterday from an authoritative source that he said that he didn't think the clock went to zero. That's impossible. He could not have seen it because it synced up with the television, so you can see it clearly on TV. There's an easy fix.
So, that was one of the questions.
That was one of the questions from the broadcast.
Right. What were we seeing on TV, was that completely synced to the official game clock?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So therein lies the easy fix. Make that reviewable, make that play reviewable, and let the pseudo sky judge, or whatever they call him, that's in the replay assistant, that's in the booth, call down to the field immediately and tell the official, wave it off, stop the play. We've got delay of game and away you go.
So just to get into this for a second, because it's also kind of interesting with what we talked about with Mike Bill, with, you know, the rules and then the approved ruling, the application of the rules, which is, you know, I think of as black letter law and case law, because my understanding is that the actual way they administrate this is whichever judge should be looking at the clock and seeing the clock sees the clock. And after he sees it hit zero, you don't blow the whistle. Then he then looks to the center. And if the center is in the process of snapping the ball, they allow that to have been tradition. That has been the way it's been.
That's correct. That's the correct mechanic.
So in this case, the delay was that that the center had not even started snapping the ball, therefore was not in process. Therefore, there's those sort of slight wiggle room in the mechanics were not appropriate because that's supposed to take about a second. It took 1.57 seconds, right? I think that's it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was way too, as Gene Steratore said on CBS after the game, it was far too long to be explainable by the official looking at the clock and then looking to see if the ball is snapped.
Now, why wouldn't he be able to see the, I mean, I know where he is, but
he's way in the backfield. He's way in the backfield, and there's someone could be blocking the center. There could be a nose tackle over the center. There could be a defender in the way. There could be another official in the way.
I thought he said he didn't see the clock hit zero, which would mean
he claimed he didn't see the clock hit zero.
But there's no place on the field where you can't see one of the clocks.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, that was just.
I will say one other thing.
A misremember, to be charitable.
Just in a fairness, I mean, Justin Tucker's one of the greatest kickers in the history. I mean, both in terms of.
Well, that's fine, but that's immaterial.
You're right. I'm just referring to, absolutely nothing to the play. But I'm saying he's a Hall of, in my mind, he's a Hall of Fame kicker anyway. That's all.
Well, you would be proud of us at our house. I turned to my father-in-law and said, Bill's going to hate this.
Yeah. Well, that was obvious. That was obvious. And what's interesting, I thought also, and very speaks to the sort of divide we have in the country about what people want to read in terms of reinforcing in echo chambers. When you read everything in the Detroit press, they were going crazy. In the Baltimore press, they're making it very iffy and maybe, and then, you know, kind of defending the thing. I mean, it's all, you know, as my old undergraduate constitutional law professor Bill used to say, it's all a question of whose ox is being gored. So that's where you come at things.
But the, you know, was it John Adams that said facts are stubborn things? The facts are that they missed
right.
it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And there's no two ways about it. And it's easily rectifiable. The question will be, there's no question. I don't think, but what the competition committee will change this.
Yeah.
They'll make the play reviewable. Whether they do it now for the rest of the season or they do it in the off season, which I suspect is what they will do. It's going to get done. It'll change.
But one thing they can't do is change the outcome of that game.
Oh, no, they can't change the outcome of the game. No, absolutely not. And it won't matter for Detroit and, you know, Baltimore. I won't save this for this last segment, but Baltimore's living on borrowed time. They should be 1-2 at this point in time.
Yeah.
And so that won't hold up over time. That luck won't hold up over time.
Yeah,
it will not.
Well, we won't have it today, but that leads me to a whole nother discussion I want to ask you about. But anyway, okay, Scott.
All right, well, here we go. Well, Bill, we did not pick this topic because me and all of my friends are a little bit nervous, but we're keeping our temperature down. But we wanted to dive a little bit into and talk broadly about your philosophy around roster moves during the season, how they work, cap implications and all those kinds of things. So in terms of roster moves during the season, can you talk a little bit about what your philosophy was and then how the Division of Labor worked in the front office during the season?
Sure. Let me explain first and foremost what roster moves define roster moves during the season. The first are what we call fringe back of the roster moves. That would start with rotating spots on the practice squad. There's a 16-man practice squad now, so you have some rotatable spots in order to try out as many players as you can. Now, the reason for the 16-man practice squad is that the coaches want a full complement of players to act as a scout team every week. And since they don't have walk-ons and redshirts in the National Football League, because walk-ons and redshirts don't get paid, they have people called the practice squad who get paid upwards of $100,000 a year if you stay on it the whole season. So they have to have enough people to practice based upon where their injury situation is in a given week. So if you're short of DBs, for example, in a given week, then you'd go out and add DBs to the practice squad.
Hey, Bill, so do the practice squad players get – do they get paid the same way players do, where they get game checks, or how are they compensated?
Okay. Yes, they get game checks. Mm-hmm. So that's one move that you would make during the season, filling the practice squad either to get a full complement of practice players or because you want to continually churn some positions and look for people. We did not believe in churning. We did not believe in churning, period. So, but there are teams that do, New England's being one of them. Second way, the second reason you add players is because a player that you have a very high opinion of becomes available via the waiver wire. So let's, for argument's sake, say that you have a very high opinion on a guard, Ryan Lilger, who is tiny by the standards of the National Football League. Nobody else would really want him, but he fits perfectly for us with the Colts. So he's a claim, and you claim him, and when you get him, you cut somebody from the active roster in order to let him come on and make your team better. Those are relatively rare, relatively rare. The third way you add players is, there's actually four ways here. The third is off the street. The same criteria holds true. Is there a guy on the street who's better than the guy you're playing with, or the guy that would come up from the practice squad? If that's the case, then you add him and you cut somebody from the regular roster. Now, waiver pickups and street guys get, if they go to the active roster, get paid full salary, so cap consequences come into the picture. Do you have cap room to accommodate the guy? If he's on the street, he has no contract, but you have to negotiate a contract with him that's cap friendly. Otherwise, he won't come.
So are those contracts prorated? How does that work?
Yes, they're prorated. They're prorated. Yeah, they're absolutely prorated. So those would be the ways that you would add players in a voluntary way. I'm doing this
right
to make my team better.
One way or another, yeah.
The involuntary way you add players is when a top player goes down, and almost always when you have a rash of injuries at a position, which frequently happens, Lady Luck not only doesn't smile on you, she urinates on you. And so, pardon the indelicate reference there.
But Bill, that was the left out verse from Guys and Dolls and Luck Be a Lady Tonight.
So when that happens, when you get one injury to position, you usually get a couple of more. That can be exacerbated by the age of people at a certain position. So in Tampa Bay's case, they've got some injuries at, you know, a rash of injuries in the defensive backfield, but they also got some guys that are, you know, relatively old on the team. So they could have future injuries there that would be a problem for them throughout the season. That's involuntary because you have to take the person who's injured and you need to put him on, make him inactive or put him on injured reserve, one of the two. So then you are forced either to make a trade, as Jacksonville and who traded with Jags? I'm drawing a blank.
Pittsburgh.
Carolina.
Oh, yeah. No. I was thinking the wrong trade. Sorry.
You know, you're Carolina, you lose your number one draft choice.
Yeah.
Excellent DB who was, you know, looking like he had a shot at rookie of the year. certainly playing and playing well, and you lose him for the season, now you have to go make a trade that you didn't want to make and give up something you don't want to give up. That's involuntary. So those are the ways that you add players during the season, none of which are particularly palatable, because it almost always means that you're either deficient at a position in terms of skill and competitiveness, or because you're fighting off injury.
Two questions in follow-up, Bill. One is just the mechanics. You've told our listeners, who are internally the longtime listeners, have heard this a number of times in great detail, how you set up a draft board and follow draftable players, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's 1,700 guys who are going to flow through the NFL about every year these days. A, how do you go about being aware with any depth so that you can make a move like that in terms of these, you know, better guys, but also the fringe guys who might be better than where you now have a hole? And the second thing is, if you do have to make a trade, which is, you know, the emergency situation, what is your philosophy about being willing to give up a player versus giving up a draft pick?
Two very different questions, slightly related, but very different.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's answer the first one by describing what a typical pro personnel operation would look like. If you look at a team's press guide, you'll see scouts and executives listed. One will be pro personnel director. They'll likely be a person with the title of personnel director, another with the title of pro personnel director, another with the title of director of college scouting. Those titles are descriptive. They're self-identifying. Then there will be anywhere from 6 to 9 college scouts. That's what they do. They specialize only in college. And then there'll be anywhere from 3 to 5 pro scouts and a pro director. They specialize only in NFL and CFL players, pro players. The way you divide the workload up is to give each of the pro scouts, if you have 4, a division and a half. I've come to believe with the expansion of rosters and things like that, you need 6 pro scouts, 1 for each division. And your own division, you know well, you know, everybody knows that. You don't need somebody to cover your own division. So they specialize in the division. When I was a pro scout way back when, I spent upwards of 5 hours a day reading the sporting news. The New York Times, Sporting News was particularly helpful. The football news, Sporting News was weekly, Football News was weekly, Times was daily, following every transaction and then going back and making notes on the people that I was responsible for. Nowadays, it's a lot easier because everybody gets the film. And so the pro scouts go over the film of teams to whom they are assigned, and they grade everybody every week. So there is a computerized file on all of those 1,700 players. You're not interested in all 1,700, obviously.
Right.
And
right.
So, for example, you know, you might, if you were responsible for the Indianapolis Colts in our heyday, you might write a cursory report on Peyton Manning, knowing full well that he's not leaving.
Right, that's not happening.
That's not happening. And even if he did, you'd have enough film to be able to go back and in a 24-hour period get a perfectly good report on him. What you want to concentrate on are the mid-level players who may become available via trade or otherwise. And you have to be in-depth on those. And nowadays, and even in our day, we were able to make the computer interface work in such a way that when you push Scott Schaefer's button, up comes all his college data and all his pro data. So all I have to do is, as a general manager, is go to my computer and bring up Scott Schaefer. And nowadays, I will get not only all of his data, and all of the reports written on him, I'll get all of his film.
Yeah. Right.
So.
And my pro film was much better than my college film.
That's because you paid the guy.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is that there's a dearth of there is no dearth of material available, and they're responsible for everybody in their division. So if, for example, let's just pick a name out of the Ryan Lilger. Okay, good example. He came by the waiver wire. First of all, we loved him coming out of college. And we loved them in the preseason film. But the first thing I would do would be to go to the guy who was responsible for Kansas City and say, okay, tell me about Lilja. And then tell me, you know, why are they cutting him? Are they going to cut him? Does he fit with us? He's the first stop. The pro scout responsible for that team is the first stop for the general manager when you begin to discuss a player. And he is always in any meeting that discusses that player, at least for us, he was. The pro director comes in, he will have an opinion. The pro director looks at the very likely guys that will come on the wire. He looks at a lot of people, and he will have an opinion. And both of them will have background on the guy. So that, you know, the first question you ask is, this guy's a good player, why are they cutting? Well, you know, Hudson Hawks, the offensive line coach, and he wants big guys. They don't really like him. Dick Vermeil loves him. He said good things about him in the paper. My guess is that Vermeil doesn't want to cut him, but the offensive coaches may force his hand. Those are the kind of discussions that you have. That actually was the case, by the way. Hudson Hawks may not have been the offensive line coach. I may be wrong about that, but Dick did not want to cut him. And Dick was furious when we claimed him on waivers. He's told me that on a number of occasions. And I guess some people in the pro department and maybe even Carl Peterson got an earful from Dick about the fact that Lilja was claimed. But that's how it works. And so the pro director now, as we get nearer the November 1 trade deadline, is compiling and assigning reports for players who are even on the rumor mill. So to use a prime example and an obvious example, everybody in the league who does not have a great quarterback, which means 26 out of 32 teams, will say, give me everything you got on Deshaun Watson.
Right.
So Deshaun, the pro personnel directors in the National Football League know more about Deshaun Watson than the prosecutor in Houston does. Because every NFL team has a security department. So every NFL security department has touched every person they can touch in Houston to try and find out all there is to know about Mr. Watson's contract attempts. So that's a perfect example of it. Now that's the most glaring and obvious one. There are plenty of other players who might or might not be available by a trade who people are studying. And if you have a glaring weakness, as the Panthers did, once they lose that number one corner and they see themselves as a contending team, then the general manager says to the pro personnel, and sometimes he doesn't even have to. When I was the pro director, you know, I prided myself on being able to go to Coach Stevenson and say, listen, you know, our left corner is not cutting it. Do you want me to go looking in the marketplace? And his answer would be, yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So you anticipate that.
Right.
And you get ready for trades. In the old days, the teams with the best scouting operations and the most efficient scouting operation did best.
Yeah.
There were teams, I won't name any, that were awful and then you could fleece. And if they offered you somebody in the trade, you know, you'd research the guy and you'd say, yeah, this guy's pretty good. Why are they trading him? And someone in the room would say, yeah, that's them. You know,
yeah, right.
Yeah, you're right.
right way to say there is.
Yeah, like when we traded Champ Bailey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was good.
So that's how those things develop. And when I say someone in the room, these are never unilateral decisions, never. And they're all personnel department decisions with all the inputs that I've given you. So that a meeting that talks about let's talk about a Champ Bailey trade. There's a prime example. This is a blue player, an outstanding player who's coming on the market. And for whatever reason, and you figured out the reason, you know,
right.
You'd know the reason.
Yeah.
And Charles Haley is another example. I mean, you figured out the reason pretty quickly why Charles Haley was on the market.
Yeah.
So, and let me add an aside here. Charles Haley reminds me of an obvious situation that fans may not know of. When Charles Haley gets crossways and gets suspended by Bill Walsh, the first thing the pro scout who's responsible for the 49ers does is call a trusted media source in that city and say, hey, tell me why Charles Haley's got in trouble. And if the guy doesn't know, you may say to him, do me a favor, find out about this, okay? And the guy will say, yeah, okay, and come back to you with a generally reliable report. And it would not be uncommon for that guy to get a check for, you know, $1,500 or $1,000.
Really?
You know, as a way of saying thank you. Yeah, that's how you cultivate sourcing.
Okay.
Dinner at Five Candied Hams.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Any number of things.
Yes.
A generous Christmas present.
Yes.
You know.
Right.
Yeah, I wasn't kidding. Yeah. I know of a case. I know of some guys who got those.
Or you know, in this day and age, and even in my time, because it was not necessarily reportable income. I'm probably ranging too far afield here, but, you know, as a thank you, a signed jersey from your quarterback.
I just want to say, in my experience, you know, guys become sports reporters because they like sports. And when they get a chance to talk to, I won't say Bill Polian because he might not have ever done anything like that, but Joe Schmo, who is the GM here, or feel like they've contributed to a team, they like that. They kind of get off on that they're...
Well, and sometimes they become general managers.
They're insider themselves. Well, that's actually happened, but yeah.
Yeah, no. We have one in the city who that just happened that way. So, hey, Bill, to this point, just real quick.
Remember my second question.
Yeah. We'll get to the second, but this is related. So would you get... So, like, in terms of... I'm assuming scouting practice squad players is functionally really difficult. Because you don't get to see them, you know, you don't have any tape on them. You just hear what's happening.
You're going off their college reports and whatever preseason tape you have.
But could you get reports the same way from local reporters on if practice squad players are looking really good in practice?
No. They won't give you that.
They won't. Okay. All right.
No, not if they're ethical. No.
Okay. But that's just a straight wheel and deal, roll the dice. You're going off whatever tape you have to try to pluck somebody off a practice squad.
Yeah. I won't say that it doesn't happen, but certainly not in my experience. And no coach or owner that I ever worked for would allow it. I mean, you don't do that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I was once ordered to spy on a practice of an opponent and I flatly refused and went to the general manager and said, thank you, I quit.
Right.
And you know, he said, no, don't quit. I'll handle it. And he did.
Right.
But
now, did they give you a video camera?
No.
No, I'm kidding.
No, they did not. No,
I'm kidding. Just kidding.
They wanted me to go to the practice.
they were still in film those days.
Yes.
Yeah. It was not they. It was the guy that happened to be the personnel director at the time. Once you compile that information, then you have a meeting which consists of the pro director. College director is usually on the road, but if he's at home, he'll be part of it. The assistant GM, whoever's responsible for cap, it's usually the assistant GM would be responsible. If it's a difficult cap issue, you'd bring the cap guy in, but not normally. At least we didn't. We did not want him to be privy to personnel discussions. It was, you know, what belongs to Caesar, and what belongs to God belongs to God. We didn't want the two lines crossing. If there was a specific question, bring them into the meeting, have them answer the question, and leave. I still believe that that's the correct way to do it, because leaks are a dangerous thing. And, you know, cap guys talk to cap guys, and before you know it, stuff's out there. Not that scouts don't.
Right. Plus, Bill, you don't want the cap guy opining on how good of a player. I mean, why does he? Yeah.
That's great. Well, they typically they're smart enough not to do that.
Yeah. I mean, but
they'll say, I don't think the value is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Buzzword for owners. And,
right. Even that they don't know what they're doing.
So anyway, all of that takes place in a group setting. And then once all of that is vetted, then you bring the coach in and he's not brought in. You go to his office and say, okay, look, we got so-and-so hurt. Here's who we think the three best guys are, and here's what they're going to cost us. And here's how we can, you know, we think we can best acquire them. And if one is far more outstanding than the other, then you make that clear. And he may or may not check with the position coach or the coordinator, but my feeling has always been that I'll always defer to the head coach. I'll always defer, not always, but almost always defer to the coordinator. Not really interested in the position coach's point of view unless he's been with the player before, and then only what the personality part of it is. Because pro position coaches are preparing for a game every week. They're not scouting. And as a result, they'll give you, they remember what they remember of the player years before.
Right.
And as Mike Giddings once famously said, today, now is now, and yesterday was yesterday.
Right. Yeah. So when you said in just fleetingly there, what it's going to cost us, that's not from a negotiation. That was from a cap standpoint. That was from a, this is the hit we're going to take.
Were draft choices involved? You give them an estimate of what it will cost.
So, and how would you have actually reached out to the other team?
You put an internal value on the player. So let's use the Carolina, Jacksonville trade as an example.
Mm-hmm.
They were giving up a tight end who was a pretty good contributor to their team.
Yeah.
So that was something of value. That was not a throw. So then they say to themselves, listen, I'm only willing to pay a pittance in addition to this player.
Right.
So what's the top we would give for this guy whom we think can come in and play for us, who's got 4 years of control? That's important because that's part of the cost at a low salary. And what are we in effect giving up? So Arnold, I'm giving you my value now. This is not Matt Rhule doing this equation. I don't pretend to speak for him. Arnold is probably a fourth, the equivalent of a fourth. That's from a player acquisition standpoint, almost meaningless because it's hit or miss. It's 50% hit, 50% miss. And so the next question is, what would they want in addition to that? Well, the guy they're acquiring, Henderson, is a one, and he's got 4 years of control. So if they ask for a one in return, they know they're being greedy and unreasonable because number one draft choices who played a little time in the league are like used cars, like new cars. Once you drive them off the lot, they depreciate.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. So the best they could ask for would be a two.
Right.
Reasonably.
Yeah.
So you then say, I'm not paying a two for this guy. This is internal. You're having conversations with yourself. I'm not going to pay a two for this guy. He's not that good of a player. And besides which, I've never forgotten this aside here. We'd put a parenthesis about this if we were writing it around it. George Allen once told me, and Marv Levy reiterated, that nobody trades anybody that can help them.
Right.
So I've never forgotten that.
Right.
So the question is, you know, why are they trading him?
Yeah.
He's only played a few games. He hasn't dressed for many this year. There's a reason for that, et cetera, et cetera. So you say, there's no way I'm paying a two for this guy. That's crazy. We can get a guy off the street who we won't have control for 4 years, and he might play as well.
Right.
So then let's just say that the coach has a real feel for the guy and wants him And I say, gee, you know, what do you think would be reasonable? He says, what do you think would be reasonable? What could you live with? And I'd probably say, we'll give him Arnold and a fourth, two fourths. So if the coach is Tony Dungy or Jim Caldwell or Dom Capers or Marv Levy, particularly Marv, he'll say, now Marv would be okay with that because Marv was famous for undervaluing players and deals. Dom and Tony might say, listen, the likelihood is that, you know, he'll play for us even if he's a backup for three more years, maybe four. What would you pay for a backup corner? And so if I was stubborn, I'd say, still a fourth. Let me say I was in a bad mood and being stubborn. And Tony would respond, well, you know, we had these two guys we drafted in the third who weren't any good. We replaced them, you know, after 2 years. Yeah, you're right. We missed on them. Okay, I see your point. Highest I would go would be a third. So then if the coach is one of those guys that I mentioned, he would say, well, okay, offer him the fourth. Offer him the two fourths and see what they say.
Yeah.
So, okay. So now I go back and I call my counterpart. And this is a big trade, so it would be done by the general manager. Otherwise, the assistant GM would do it if it were lesser price involved. And I would say, you know, what do you want for Henderson? Oh, well, you know, Billy's a one. We need a tight end badly. We got to get a tight end that can play right away, and we probably a two. You know, I couldn't do it for anything less than a two. And so now it's my turn to bait the hook. He's told me he needs a tight end badly. I know that already. So I say, well, how about Arnold? And say, yeah, okay. Yeah, Arnold would be okay because he's done his homework as well. So I say, well, I couldn't possibly give you anything more than a four. I mean, Arnold's going to start for you right away. That's worth at least a two. And you know, he's going to play a while. No, I can't do that. I can't do that. Now, if the guy's a good guy and a smart negotiator, he'll say, and particularly in that situation, he'll hide behind the coach. He'll say,
yeah,
let me go back to coach and see what he's willing to look at.
Right.
Okay. And you do the same. So, okay, my responsibility, I don't want to get Tony involved, but do you want Arnold? Yeah, we want Arnold. Yeah, for sure. All right, then I'll go to Tony. Otherwise, I wouldn't go to Tony and bother him with this. He's got a team to coach. Yeah, okay. You go talk to your coach and I'll talk to mine and let's get back together tonight, okay? Okay. So we both go and report back saying and they want a two and I offered a four. So you know
where you're gonna meet.
Yeah, and if the coach wanted him, he would say, Can you bring yourself to offer the three? And I go, yeah.
And then you're like, I'm going to get a five back.
Yeah, well, that's just window dressing. And then so if both the coach and I forgot to add that once this process started, you would inform the owner that there's a trade in the working in a making, and that here's who's involved, and you know, you keep them abreast of what's going on. So then, I'd go back to him and say, listen, I've spoken to Tony, and we're willing to offer Arnold. We'll offer Arnold and a third, and if they won't accept that, we won't do.
Right.
So
that's what happened.
I learned this from Jim Finks. I was a shave-tailed general manager. We were playing the Saints in the preseason. Morton Anderson was holding out. And Jim said to me, I got to negotiate with Morton's agent. He was the day of the game. I got to negotiate with Morton's guy. No cell phones in those days. Would you mind if I used your office? He said, you got an ante room back there. I said, no, use my office and desk. I said, just one. Could I listen in? He said, yeah, sure. So sat down, listened. Jim was – could charm the birds out of the trees. So everything was fine, and they were agreeing to disagree. And the agent made an offer, and Jim made a counter, and the agent came back to him, and I think essentially in the counter, Jim said, "Listen, this has gone on long enough. I got to fish or cut bait here. You know, I can't have the coach go into the season without a kicker. So if you're not going to accept this, then I got to take it off the table and go elsewhere." And so the agent came back and asked for a little more. And Jim said, Jim had sparkling blue eyes, but when he decided to get his German up, and he was partly Irish, so good combination.
Yeah.
Those eyes would turn steely, and his jaw would set, and his tone of voice would deepen. And he simply said, "That's enough." and the guy said, "Okay."
Deal. Yeah. Some, you know, what we need to do, we need to get in touch with Billy Kuharik and have him send us that list of Finksisms.
Oh, well, we'll get Billy on and talk about it. We'll talk about it. We'll do a Jim Fink story. So
there's, you know, one of the great characters as well as one of the great professionals.
So anyway, the bottom line is I've always used that advice, and it helps me to not blow my top when the guy asks for just a little more at the end. So now, in the immortal words of Jim Finks, that's enough.
I want to try to sort of drill down deeper philosophically with this one, because it is a different question. So, because you've said a lot of things, you've taught us a lot over, you know, the episode. There's a value on a draft pick, and obviously the higher the draft pick, the more value. But we also know that draft picks often fail, completely fail, as with our analysis of first-round quarterbacks. So when you're talking about trading a real live player who has shown you, you have a track record, you know what he can do in general, you know what he can do with your team. When you are giving something for something else, what is your philosophy on giving something that could be of great value or something that could be worthless, a draft pick, versus giving a known quantity? How do you weigh that?
Well, if you're giving up a player to acquire a player, it's a pretty simple equation. Is the player you're giving up someone that can help you, the George Allen maxim? And if you can't, if you are, then you better be getting something better in return.
Right. But what I'm saying is, would you sooner, if you could, would you rather give up a draft pick to get that player who you know can help you? Or would you rather give up a player?
No, I would rather give, well, first of all, I'd rather give up a player who couldn't help.
Right.
but the likelihood is, yeah, the likelihood is that they're not going to accept that.
Right. So good, you know, good, but not great, you know.
I'd rather give the draft choice in that case, because the draft choice is not sure to make it. And then you come into, then there's nuance involved. How high do you expect to be drafting? How high, if you're giving up, first of all, let's go back to the value of draft choices. Firsts are only given up for comparable players. Seconds are given up very reluctantly. Firsts only for blues, seconds only for reds, thirds, you know, there's maybe a low red for a third.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, with any of those first three rounds worth of drafts, in the first round, you have control of the player for effectively 6 years if you tag him. In the second and third rounds, it's effectively 4 years. So you're giving up club control and low price mm-hmm. for a guy who ostensibly is not the same person and or has the same club control. So that's the nuance. And then where are you drafting? Where is that choice going to be exercised?
Right.
So that's why I don't want to digress and go into the NBA. It's too complicated to explain. The bottom line is that would I rather give a choice? Yes. Would I rather give a fourth and below? Absolutely, because the odds of hitting on that are, you know, you're a loser most of the time.
Yeah.
That's why most trades involve thirds and maybe a sweetener, because though that value is really 50-50 when it's all said and done. And you're hoping to get back more than that.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to get into firsts and seconds, now you better be getting a player that's going to be a difference maker.
Right. So two final things here. I remember when I was heavily agenting and I did my analysis, at that point anyway, I saw the fifth round as the one where below it, there was less than a 50% chance of even making the team. And at the fifth round, it was just about, now I'm not talking about being a star or being a starter, but at round five, you were still at a 50-50 chance of making the team. Did that change or?
Yeah, it's changed. The modern metrics tell you that the fourth round is virtually 50-50.
Okay. And then the one other thing I wanted to mention, which you casually mentioned.
By the way, let me just interject. The vast majority of your players who make up your team, who are winning players, who you can build your team around, are first, second, and third round draft.
Yeah. Although, of course, amazingly, there are free, you know, college free agents.
There's exceptions, but.
Yeah. But so the other thing you mentioned, which I just like you to expand on a little, and you just threw it out there. I don't even know if you remember saying it. You said, you're in this situation if you're a contender, because that brings us back to the great discussion of developing, you know, a franchise versus developing the team for this year. So take into account what you do. You're, you know, a key starting guy goes down, you need him. If you're not a contender, if that happens when you're already, you know, you've already lost 9 games in the season, how does that change your calculus?
Well, if you lost 9, you're beyond the trade deadline anyway.
Sorry. I was trying to make it as bad as I could. All right. The last, you've lost, you know, only won 1 game before.
You're 2-5. You know, you look at, if you're 2-5 in a 17-game season, we don't have any metrics on this, but you're probably, with 10 games left, you're probably still alive. I mean, you could run the table and be 12-5, right?
So you're going to take that shot.
Logically speaking, you could have a hot streak and finish 13-4.
Okay.
And that might be good enough, you know, to sneak into the playoffs. So that's the calculation. Do I have a chance to make the playoffs? If I have no chance to make the playoffs, let's for argument's sake, say you're the Jets or Detroit or somebody that doesn't look like they have a lot of firepower, then you're thinking, how do I make the team better in the future?
Right.
Do I bring in a young player to replace this injured guy who might have some upside? Or do I go for Richard Sherman?
Yeah.
You got to think Goff's interesting if a contending team has an injury at quarterback.
I don't know how they value him. Who knows who's making the decisions there? I mean, it's all that's muddled. I'd be loath to make a trade with them because you don't know. And while in Goff's case, you know what you're getting, but in some of their other people, I mean, they try to trade Collins, right?
Yeah, no taker.
There were no takers. I mean, who's going to take Collins? He's a 3-time loser. And Bill sent him packing and Patricia, you know.
Did that deal. So
did that. Yeah. So, I mean, what are you going to do? You can see on the film that he's probably not a guy you want on your team.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, when I read in the paper that, well, they're trying to, or on the internet, they're trying to trade Jamie Collins, I laugh because I say, well, but then on the other hand, I know GMs and I know people who worked with me who would say, give it a try. You know, someone might bite. There's no harm in it. Yeah. Okay. Let's don't leak it though. We don't leak that. That hurts the marketplace, but that's Detroit. So it leaks.
Yeah. they may see it as a trial balloon, but I think that's a trial balloon that burst.
Very it's true.
A trial balloon that never got blown up.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a good transition into, okay, we've got 3 weeks in the books. Bill, what did you think of some of the action in week three? And how worried should I be?
How worried should you be?
Folks, you know, this whole show exists just so Bill can advise Scott about exactly. the Washington football team.
We have a lot of football team fans on the pod, so.
All right.
First of all, I would be loath to write anybody off at this point in time. So I would probably say we're going to do this after everybody's played five games. And I actually went back and checked, and five games is the right number because no bye will have taken place until week six. So everybody will be on an even playing field with five games. What I look for now is competitive, what I like to call competitive ability. So the Jets are not competitive as we look at them now. There are a ton of weaknesses. And the quarterback is not to blame. The Bears are not competitive offensively because of the line and because Dalton is out. But even with Dalton back or with Foles in there, still only marginally competitive offensively. And defensively, there's decline there. So I worry a little bit about the Bears going forward. Jacksonville is non-competitive. And I think they know that. I think they know that. That's one of the reasons they're, you know, they traded Henderson. You know, he doesn't figure in their future plans. On the other hand, Indianapolis is losing really tight games. And the reason is because they're undermanned because of injuries, particularly on the offensive line. They've gotten no solidification on the offensive line because of injuries. Both tackles have been out. Now the best guard in football is out. It's been a mess on the offensive line. And T.Y. Hilton has not been on the field either. So they're in a position where if they can get healthy, they have a chance. The Giants have been surprisingly inefficient on defense because you'd think the talent would be better. They have not gotten any receivers, by and large, on the field. They've taken turns getting hurt.
And then tweeting about it.
Yeah, well, that's another issue. Are they, in the end, good enough? We don't know at this point. We don't know at this point. Pittsburgh, offensive line, clearly worrisome. Clearly worrisome. Ben, you know, why is it that everybody blames the quarterback? You know, Ben's arm is not as strong as it was. I mean, we can see that. We have eyes. But he's smart. He can deliver the ball on time. He's got good receivers. Dante Johnson has decided to catch the ball, which is a wonderful thing. He now is a major league contributor. Juju's still Juju. Freiermuth is a big upgrade at tight end.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell? You know, can the offensive line be solidified? Don't know. That's worrisome. That's Chicago of the AFC. You know, because if you can't block anybody, you can't protect your quarterback.
Yeah,
you can't make any plays. The running back in Pittsburgh is the real deal. There's no question about that. So they're worrisome. They're worrisome. And that offensive line is not bereft of injury. It may be bereft of talent. It's certainly bereft of cohesion. Defensively, they need Watt back. They need Watt back. Once he gets back, I think they'll be good enough defensively. So they're worrisome. Baltimore, as I mentioned previously, you know, has been living under a lucky star. They should be 1-2 and not 3-0. So they're a mirage in a sense. Now, part of that is defensive injuries. But, you know, still, they're not a 3-0 team. as presently constant.
They're 2-1. They're 2-1. They lost that Raiders game. Yeah,
they lost the Raiders game. I apologize. So they should be 0-3. Actually,
but they were close to being 3-0.
Yeah,
but they probably should be 0-3, right?
They should be 0-3 because you can't predict the fumble. I mean, I'll give them the fumble. Okay, the Penn State kid caused the fumble, so I'll give them that. It's a lousy play call, and it's the wrong guy carrying the ball, but I'll give him that. So 1-2. They should definitely have lost this last week's game. And to perform that way against the Lions is, oof, come on, you know. Yeah, everybody has a downer. I understand that, but still.
You're supposed to get well against the Lions.
Well, not only are you supposed to get well, but you're supposed to beat them on talent alone. You're supposed to beat them on talent alone. If Lamar Jackson is the MVP, he finds a way to win that game. He doesn't need the referee to help. So, but now, having said that, the running back situation will probably get better. Those guys are easy to replace. And defensively, will they get healthy? We'll see. We'll find out. So don't write them off. And at 2-1, you don't write them off. Are they as good as Cleveland? We'll find out. In the West,
it's going to be a street fight to the finish.
You talk about
the AFC West looks tough, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it may come down to who has the best quarterback. Except that Kansas City is worrisome, very worrisome on defense. Why is Jones playing outside and not in? I'll write off the game plan against Baltimore as an aberration. You know, everybody tries something once and it doesn't work. That's fine. And they could have won the game anyway, should have won the game. But they worry me on defense. I don't think it's not a championship defense as presently constituted.
Broncos 3-0 anomaly.
Yeah, it's an anomaly. They played three teams, the question is: does Teddy stay healthy? Number one, but please God, he does. And number two, can against San Diego, against Kansas City, against the Raiders, you know, how do they perform? We don't know that yet. We don't know that yet.
Bill, do you think that the game against the Chargers was a little bit of a statement game by the Chargers and how they, especially, I think they've gotten killed from a little bit how they approached the end of that game. But I feel like that was like a, we're here, we're coming to win, and we're going to take this from you.
That to me is a kind of a media statement.
Okay.
I'm dispassionate, you know, as a scout, I'm dispassionate. I kind of discount that stuff. I know it's important in the moment. And I know it's important in preparation to get the team focused. But I think in the end, when you look at San Diego, what you see is the next great quarterback in the league, the guy that's going to stand next to Mahomes, and you're going to say, which guy do you want? These are the two best. These two are the heir to Tom and Peyton.
How do you see Carr?
Not in the same league. Good, but not in the same league with Mahomes and
right
and San Diego's guy.
But Josh Allen could get there, maybe, right?
No,
you don't think so.
It does not have the natural gifts that those two have.
Okay.
Let me see if I can give you. I hadn't prepared this comparison, so forgive me for the moment. Pedro Martinez and Roger Clemens. Josh Allen is Andy Pettit.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it feels good. That's okay.
The other two.
True.
Unhittable stuff.
And that it doesn't mean you wouldn't love to have Andy Pettit starting.
No. Andy Pettit 7 days a week. Can't have the other two. You want Andy Pettit 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. And the same is true of Josh Allen.
What about is he Mike Mussina?
No. He's better than Mike Mussina. He has more gifts than Mike Mussina.
All right. Mussina's pretty good down here in Baltimore.
Pretty good. Listen, Hall of Famer. But
and Stanford guy.
I'm talking about is that Kansas, you know, Patrick and the guy in San Diego have gifts
Josh Herbert
that exceed anyone else in the league.
Right.
other than the established stars, you know, Green Bay.
Rodgers, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, Rodgers, Brady, you know. Those two guys have a chance to be Hall of Famers because of their gifts. And so in the end, that may, in that division, in the end, that might make the difference. I don't know if San Diego's quite as complete as they would like to be, and they need to get a left tackle back that they can count on. And I don't know if Bakhtiari comes back from injury. We'll see. I don't know if they're quite as complete as they'd like to be on defense, but we'll see. Certainly Denver is very complete on defense, but they got a little age on them. So, you know, injury will play a role there, and debilitation may play a role there. The Raiders are young and feisty, and thus far on defense, pretty damn good. So that one's largely decided by who's healthy and who's not.
Well, and also from a fan's perspective, you get another game of the Raiders and Chargers like last year, and we get two of those this year. Let's do it. Let's watch that every week.
Oh, sure.
Hey, Bill, this is just something I've been thinking about. In offensive line, as we look around and see the ones that are having problems, some of it's injuries, some of it's talent, but I don't know. For some reason, I'm feeling like as a group, more than any other group, I don't know what else to call it other than another line from guys and dolls, chemistry. Chemistry seems to me, in other words, their ability to really, truly know what the other guys are going to do, anticipate, meld into a unit. I feel like that seems to be the place where it's most important. If they don't, even if you have five good individuals, if they don't have that ability to intuit and know and how to switch, that things fall apart. Am I off on that?
No, you're not off. The word I often use is continuity. Here's how you construct an offensive line. You get a great left tackle. You don't settle. You get a great left tackle. You work like hell to get him. Just like you don't settle for a mediocre quarterback. You work like hell to get a great left tackle because he is the linchpin of your line. The next guy you get is the center. He's got to be your smartest guy. He's got to be a leader on par with your quarterback and the other great leaders on your team. He has to be a great leader. He's got to be very tough. He's got to be very smart. He controls the whole operation. You take that off the quarterback. Then you need a right tackle. And the right tackle these days has to be a better pass protector than he did in years past. So you're looking for a guy with really good feet and really good athletic ability. You do not need a road grader there. In fact, you don't want a road grader there. You want a more athletic guy, whether you want to run the ball or not. You want a guard you can run over on third and one and fourth and one, or third and three or fourth and three. Who's reliable. That's the one place where you need a road grader. And then the other guard should be someone who's reasonably good and can handle what you need. All five need to be smart. They need to be smart because it's a position that requires intelligence and processing. You have to understand the concept. You have to understand the verbiage. You have to react to the verbiage. You have to react to what you see quickly in front of you, and you have to work as a unit. And then finally, they need continuity. And all of the smarts and the technique and the continuity comes from the offensive line coach. I have advised any number of head coach aspirants who call me and ask questions that, you know, the most important hire you are going to make after the coordinator on the side of the ball that you are not expert in is the offensive line coach.
Well, so in the perfect segue, as Rick is navigating us well today, we actually, our first audible is about this. So our BP1 super fan, Jared Jiggets, asked, can BP explain to layman what makes Munchak, Mudd, and Dante the best of the OL coaches? What do they do that others can't? And as his usual refrain goes, the Jets' offensive line is not good, and that's being kind.
here's what they do. Number one, they have vast understanding of scheme, and they can adjust the scheme to the nuance of the personnel that they have. So when things go wrong, they can fix stuff, to put it, you know, succinctly and bluntly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they are PhD, world-class level teachers of technique. And they can take a player who's deficient in one area and compensate for that with technique. And they can take a player who has talent but is unrefined and build him into a very competent player in a short period of time, maybe a year. They can command the room. They can command the bench on game day, which is not an easy thing to do. Remind me to expound on that in a second. And they can develop because of their understanding of the personalities in that room. And keep in mind, there are, you know, eight people in there. There are 12 usually, but there are eight that count, that all may have disparate personalities and disparate points of view. They've got to be able to meld, and they can meld those people together. And they can take those eight individuals and work with their individual skill sets and their individual personalities and build that into a cohesive unit. Ante famously said to me, he said, he expounded on what he thought was necessary physically. It was exactly the same as Howard, exactly the same. And he said, they have to be physically tough. If they're not physically tough, and keep in mind, Dante's a former Marine. If they're not physically tough, I don't want them. You can't play the position unless you're physically tough. I can make them mentally tough.
Right.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm, indeed.
That's saying something.
That is right? A little Great Santini vibe to it.
And those three guys, all kind of disparate personalities too, by the way, have the ability to do all of those things, all of those things. And what I've found interesting is that there are more than enough line coaches in America to stock three NFLs who can get on the black, on the chalkboard and give you a scheme. I mean, you could have a clinic every day of the week, 352 days a year, and find people to get up there and talk scheme. What you can't find are the guys who can take that diamond in the rough and teach him technique and make him mentally tough and teach him how to function at a high level in the NFL. And most importantly, there are only a handful. Only you can count them on the fingers of one hand. I'm forgetting two guys probably. I apologize. But there are very few who can take that room and make it a cohesive unit by understanding and melding the personalities involved. So, for example, Howard Mudd, who is loquacious, outgoing, on the field, loud, brilliant, can do all the things we talked about, never afraid to coach a player hard. Now, coaching a player hard, Howard Mudd and Tony Dungy's way, is different from somebody who would scream and call him names and things like that. They don't do that. But they would, for example, with Tarik Glenn, who was exceptionally talented left tackle, exceptionally bright. We didn't have any dummies, by the way. Howard wouldn't, can't live with him. He just can't. So we didn't bring it in. Tarik would get lazy with his steps sometimes. He would get lazy with his technique, you know, because he was so good, he could get by in most situations with less than 100% technique. And technique is important. Let me digress a moment and say technique. For those of you that have never played football or never seen offensive line coached at a high level, technique involves whether you take a 6-inch step or an 8-inch step when you're going to take a pass set. It's where you place your hand, your lead hand, when you're zone blocking on the body of the defender. It's not just reach out and hit him and grab him. It's where you place your hand. When you're pass protecting, are your thumbs up? Are they 12 inches or less apart? Because that's how you steer the man. That's how, you know. So all this technique is critically important. And it's never taught at the lower levels as well as it is at the NFL. So Tarek would get lazy occasionally with his technique. And Howard would holler. And he'd say, damn it, Tarek, I told you to take a 6-inch step and not an 8-inch step. And Tarek would say, I took a 6-inch step. My feet are, you're wrong. And Howard would say, no, I'm right. I'll show it to you on the film. We would all be sitting there like, here they go. The Odd Couple are at it again.
Get out the slide rule.
That's exactly right. Get out the slide rule. Well, you have to have the ability to then, you know, in Howard's case, Tarek would do something good and he'd say, well, damn it, Tarek, that was tremendous. I want you to do that all the time. That's why I yell at you, you know. And Tarek would just shake his head, you know. So it was, and if I let the, Jeff Saturday would say after practice on Wednesday, when we were installing the game plan, if Howard did not have a practice where there were a couple of eruptions with the offensive line, Jeff would say, I'm worried.
Something's wrong.
Howard didn't jump anybody today. What's going on?
It's not good.
That's right. Russell didn't throw up.
So you got to have that ability for 6 months a year to command that room and know exactly what the nuance and how to approach the psychology of every player is. That's to do, you have to have a rare talent to do that. That's why they're so hard to come by.
Can I, you mentioned, and you actually mentioned him earlier in the show, I'd like just like to put a word in on behalf of Hudson Hauk. I always thought,
yeah,
he was a great, just a truly great offensive line coach.
Completely different approach schematically than, yeah, but that doesn't mean anything. It's how you take that group. And then the final thing is they need to be really good judges of talent. And Dante, I won't mention the player. Dante told me something that really crystallized everything. I said, Dante, you know, this player doesn't measure up to what you described to me. But you still took him, and he's doing okay. And he said, well, we needed a guy at that position in a given year, and he was the best guy. Right. So it's my job to get the best out of him. And Bill knows, meaning Bill Belichick, and I know that he may never be an all-pro, but it's my job to make him functional because he was the best there was. That's all we can. We can't create somebody. And I thought to myself, wonderful, marvelous. I mean, great explanation. Great explanation.
Well, there you have it. All right. Well, hopefully one day the Jets offensive line will be better because we're reading these tweets almost every week. So
I will say this. I don't know the gentleman, but I've heard good things by people that I know and respect about the Jets offensive line coach. I've heard a good thing.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, hopefully Becton comes back healthy. Vera Tucker, maybe some things are changing. We'll see what happens. All right. Well, as always, if you have questions for us, hit us up on Twitter at IFBillPolling. We will be sure to cover them in the audible. Here we go, Bill. How big will the ratings be on Sunday night? Is this the highest rated NFL regular season game of all time?
Oh, probably. Probably. And in the end, you know what it means? Next to nothing. It's not even a conference game. It's not part of the tiebreaker.
Who are we rooting for in Charlotte this weekend? The quarterback or the coach?
Oh, I don't know. We're rooting for anybody, really. Bruce Arians, my friend, you know.
Yeah, so I guess maybe we have to support Tampa. So this will be fun. I think this has got to be.
Those two Bills have been getting along a lot better as well.
Yeah, this has got to be. I think this will do it. I think this will break. Let's say this. It'll break the Cowboy-Patriot game in 2019 and be the highest rated game of the decade.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me. By the way, just to end on this note, because I forgot to include this in teams that that have surprised me thus far. And I hate to go with the conventional wisdom because I know this is conventional wisdom now.
Yeah.
But the Cowboys offense is dynamite.
Pretty good.
The Achilles heel is the offensive line. And so it has to solidify and it has to survive the Collins suspension and I think they will. And defensively, they have to continue to improve, but the improvement is dramatic. And in that division, it may well be more than good enough.
I think it is. I think it might be.
So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Also, Micah will be better by the end of the year, don't you think? Micah Parsons.
Line him up and let him go, baby.
He looks so much better Monday night.
Robert Mathis, let him rip.
Yeah. Oh, he's real. He's the real.
It's going to be fun. All right. It pains me to say this, but they are actually fun to watch. That was fun on Monday night. All right, gang.
All right.
See you guys.
Thanks, everybody. Be careful out there.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.